I suppose that I'm just confused as to what it would look like for somebody to act as if they believe there was no free will. I mean, the very argument that there is...
Well, stop arguing. What does it look like for someone to have no free will? Stop making arguments to convince folks, right? It would be interesting, like an exercise, to see him have this same conversation with Jonathan Edwards, you know, or wait, maybe James White. Edwards is not alive, so... What does this have to do with the topic? Beats me! We've strayed quite a bit. Welcome back to another video here at Wise Disciple. My name is Nate, and I'm very glad that you're watching. If you're new here, this channel is all about helping you become the effective Christian that you were meant to be. That means thinking, speaking, and leading more like Jesus every single day. Make sure to click the like and subscribe button. That just helps me to get the videos out to more and more people. Also, I've partnered with Logos Bible Software, which is an absolutely amazing program. It will take you further and deeper into your Bible study than ever before. Make sure to click the link in the notes for an exclusive Logos discount. All right, today we're looking at a very interesting debate on The Big Conversation, which is connected to the show Unbelievable. It's a great show, a lot of great content. The two interlocutors are Ben Shapiro and Alex O'Connor. Now, I hesitate to use the word debate because The Big Conversation is really just that. It's a debate. It's a conversation. So we don't typically see formal segments of debate in a show like this, like opening statements and rebuttals and things. There does seem to be a kind of sort of form of cross-examination, and that's what we're probably going to focus on. The topic is religion good for society? That's really broad. Too broad, if you ask me, because one religion is not in view. All of them are, but anyway, so be it. I take it Shapiro is going to say yes, and O'Connor is going to say no. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
The principal disagreement that I think I had with you, Ben, is that there was a subtle, or not so subtle, implication in my view that yes, with no God, there's no free will. But somehow having God can solve this problem. I mean, you said a moment ago that you don't think you can establish God's existence through reason alone, but assuming that you do believe in the existence of free will, you think it's a real thing that you have.
Yes.
And simultaneously saying that if there is no God, then free will makes no sense.
Yes.
That does read to me like an argument for God's existence, such that in order to either say that there is free will, in order to say that there is free will, one must believe in God. And that does strike me as for God's existence.
So a couple of things. Number one, I'm not going to be able to react to this whole video. That would be like a 5-hour affair. So I'll do what I can. Definitely want to try and see the most replayed moment in this video with you. I think that's interesting. Number two, Shapiro just got done setting the table, so to speak, for the discussion. And he did so by attempting to set aside the notion of whether or not God exists at all. The reason he did that, I think, is clear. And I'll probably talk about that with you later. But for now, Shapiro is sort of highlighting the principles of free will, reason, morality, and objective truth. He says, because these are real features of our human existence, we cannot live consistently as materialists. And so now here comes O'Connor. He's responding. He wants to say that free will does not exist, but that also means that therefore God does not exist.
Slightly curve that or to kind of sand off the rough edges there. I would say that the argument I made is an argument for something extra natural.
Sure.
Now you can call that God or not God, but the thing that I'm making the argument for is that you cannot get from a materialist Darwinist universe to free will. That is not possible. So I know that the way you solve that is that you say that there is no free will.
That's right.
And what I'm saying to you is you don't act that way.
So you might be wondering to yourself, like, what does this discussion currently have to do with the topic, right? Isn't the topic whether or not religion is good for society? I think the reason that we're here right now, again, because Shapiro started here, is because if I had to guess, Shapiro does not want the discussion to trade on the question of whether or not God exists. Believe it or not, that's a sand trap. The real discussion is whether or not religion is good for society. And so you can, as an interlocutor, have a conversation like this without having to prove the existence of God. But it's going to have to focus then on the virtuous benefits of religion. And I think Shapiro is going to say that free will, reason, morality, and objective truth are those virtuous benefits. That's why they're talking about it right now.
I hear this all the time. People say, look, you may say there's no free will, but you don't act as though that's the case. I suppose that I'm just confused as to what it would look like for somebody to act as if they believe there was no free will. I mean, the very argument that there is...
Well, stop arguing. What does it look like for someone to have no free will? Stop making arguments to convince folks, right? Arguments and persuasion, they presuppose human freedom. The free will to draw the proper conclusions. The free will to clash with someone. So stop arguing and there you go. I mean, there's one immediate tweak that you can make right there.
No free will that I subscribe to, at least one of the various forms that it takes, is a sort of Schopenhauerian view that you can do as you will, you just can't will what you will. And that you are essentially just a biological machine reacting to its internal and evolutionary drives. That's what's happening. Now, call that nihilistic if you like. That's a separate question. But as to the question of how this would make one act, the idea that this might cause us to sort of lay around in bed all day or something, the very mechanism that I think is responsible for eliminating the possibility of free will, that is, the drives that make people do what they do, like I say, do exactly that. Make people do what they do. They make them get out of bed in the morning. Why do you get out of bed and go and make your breakfast if there's no free will? So, well, you go and get breakfast because there's no free will and something is driving you to do that that's outside of your control.
For sure. So to get back to the nihilism point, which you kind of put aside, so that means that this conversation is essentially worthless in any sort of real sense. I mean, effectively, we were driven here by evolutionary biology and environment to have this conversation. Everybody who's watching this is driven by evolutionary biology and environment to have a particular reaction to that thing, and ever round the cycle goes. That seems like a very purposeless life. Maybe, again, I'm drawing from a realm that is not evolutionarily biologically, you know, connected. The word purpose is really, teleology obviously has been taken out of the realm of science pretty thoroughly by atheists and by many people in the sciences, although I would argue that, again, most scientists speak in the realm of teleology literally all the time, and they're borrowing language from the language of teleology, even when they're describing functions of particular body parts, right? The heart pumps blood in order to keep you alive, right? They're constantly using language that's teleological in nature. Mm-hmm.
So the point that Shapiro is making is that if you adopt O'Connor's view, which is that there is no free will, then there can be no such thing as ultimate purpose. We can pretend there is, but at base there is not. Purpose requires two things. It requires, number one, a giver of purpose, and number two, the freedom to move in accordance with purpose or to reject it. And that's where Shapiro is going with this. If there is no free will because there is no God, then there can be no ultimate purpose.
The real question that I have, and this is what goes to the question that you were asking at the beginning, before the sort of pre-question question, which was the good of religion to society, one of those goods is people believing that their free will matters and this actually is a useful thing. So I believe that it is deeply important for people in society to believe that they have the capacity to change themselves and to make different decisions than what biology would drive them to. So you say, well, it's biology that drives you to get out of bed in the morning, which is almost Calvinist in sort of the way that it's described, right? It's like you're predestined to get out of bed in the morning, so thus you get out of bed in the morning. But
which is funny because Schopenhauer, who right? O'Connor says he agrees with Schopenhauer, right? I think I caught that. Schopenhauer sounds an awful lot like Jonathan Edwards. Edwards had a lot to say about human free will, wrote a lot about it. One of the fundamental things that Edwards said was that humans are only free to do what they most want to do. In other words, they can only act commensurate with their desires. That is a compatibilist view of freedom, and I think Schopenhauer was a compatibilist, if I'm not mistaken.
The reality is that we are constantly making decisions as though those decisions make a difference in the universe. And what social science actually does tend to show is that when people believe that they have control over their own actions, that when they believe that they're capable of changing the way that they live, they do make those changes with more alacrity and in better directions than if they don't believe that. If people tend to believe in a deterministic universe, they do act worse. So it may work. This is going to be sort of Straussian in its implications, but that may work for you. You're a very high IQ individual who can somehow reconcile the idea of living a very purposeful life with the idea that actually there's no purpose to anything. But for the vast majority of people, that is not actually how they live. And I would suggest that even in your daily life, you don't get out of bed in the morning thinking, man, my biology is driving me this morning to get on the bike, have a great day, the sun is shining. That's my biology doing this. And I don't think that most people who live purposeful lives, even if they believe that everything they're doing is predetermined by the world around them, by their own biology, I don't believe they actually feel that. They have to engage in what they themselves would term an illusion in order to feel a sense of purpose and meaning in their lives.
Of course, but that.
Who do you think is doing a better job so far? Like right now? I think both of these gentlemen are doing a great job. They're just having a conversation. There is not a space right now in this moment to press somebody in True Cross here. Maybe that will come later. So, but right now, they're just making their own cases. They're doing it conversationally, and it really could go either way at this point. What needs to happen, though, in my opinion, is they need to tie this back to the topic. We're supposed to be talking about, is religion good for society? And right now, I think maybe Shapiro made mention of it like in passing really quickly, but right now, we're stuck on whether or not people have free will.
That's what the evolutionary process, in my view, in my worldview, I should say, has done so well, is provide precisely that illusion. I mean, it's not as though, I mean, you say, look, you don't get out of bed in the morning thinking, gosh, you know, look at my biological
My neurons are firing, yeah.
of course not, because if I did, then the whole evolutionary purpose that this illusion serves would fall away. I mean, you say that this is a fairly purposeless life, and perhaps, you know, the implication is that it's a bit of a depressing one. I didn't come here to inspire optimism in people. I just think it is in fact the case.
By the way.
It is in fact the case that free will doesn't exist. And we may feel very nihilistic towards that, but as a wise man once said, facts don't care about your feelings. And I will say that the argument against free will, in my view, is based upon something broader than just scientific analysis or empirical research. Rather, we can build an argument, I think, from a law of logic, the proposition that P must either be true or false, and it can't be both, it can't be neither. It has to be one or the other. Now, this law of the excluded middle, one of the foundational precepts of philosophy, we can simply ask a question of any kind of mental activity, and this will be regardless of whether it's material or immaterial. That's what makes this a crucial argument, and an important one, a pertinent one, is that you can ask of that mental activity, is it determined or is it not? That is it determined by anything else or is it completely undetermined by anything? If it's undetermined by anything, then it's random, and you're by definition not in control of that which is random. If it's determined by something, then it's either determined by something further inside your mind or inside your brain or indeed inside your soul, or it's determined by something external to your brain. If it's determined by something external to yourself, I should say yourself rather than your brain here to rid this conversation of any implicit materialism, exterior to yourself, if that's what's determining the action, then clearly you're not in ultimate control of that action. If it's something inside of yourself somewhere, then all you do is push the problem back and you ask the question again, is that thing determined or is it indetermined?
Right now, O'Connor is trying to locate where human freedom exists, where it is located. This is the part where our brains start to hurt, but I'll let him finish his thought here.
Determined, it's random, determined. You keep going back until you either terminate in something outside of the self, something, or I suppose something undetermined and therefore random, either of which you are completely out of control in. If you say that it terminates in something like a soul, people like to do this. They say, well, look, with a religious philosophy, we have the benefit of introducing a soul. That doesn't solve anything. Because you still need to, it's not a matter of having to explain the mechanism by which the soul brings about actions. That may well be a mystery. But if it is the case that whatever it is that's doing that is either determined or it's not, and that if it's not, it's random and therefore out of your control, and that if it is, it ultimately terminates in something outside of yourself or something random, and both of which are out of your control, free will cannot exist.
Well,
so this is where, you know, again, yeah, your brain's probably hurting. All O'Connor is doing right here is he's trying to find the source of free human action. If I say that, you know, I pick up a cup to drink it, right? Because I had the thought to do it, then was that thought free or was that thought determined by something else that happened prior? You know, like my thirst or something, right? He's trying to pinpoint where exactly the freedom in human action actually exists. And I think he's performing this mental exercise in order to suggest that free will does not exist, because he says you cannot locate where exactly the moment of free will happened. He's, again, sounding an awful lot like a Calvinist, like a compatibilist, you know? It would be interesting, like an exercise, to see him have this same conversation with Jonathan Edwards, you know, or maybe James White. Edwards is not alive, so so I guess that would not work.
That argument does rely on the complete deconstruction of the self. I mean, you're using the term self in this argument in, I think, a couple of different ways. You're saying something outside yourself, but then you're breaking down the self into a bunch of separate components as though the self is a computer, Right? So if you took the self and you broke it down into a machine, and there's like the microchip, and you've got the processor, you've got all these different parts of it. So it has to be coming from here, or it has to be coming from here. But I think the very idea that we have of ourselves as selves is as a deciding being. And so the attempt to carve that down into, so which parts of the deciding being, that is an avoidance strategy. So I don't think that the argument quite holds.
Well, if we
all Shapiro is saying is you can't really perform this mental exercise, O'Connor, because you're digging into an area that makes no sense without human free will. So how can you disentangle aspects of free will in order to suggest that it doesn't exist in any of those parts when you cannot actually disentangle the notion of the self from free will in the first place? That's what Shapiro is saying.
Pull the self just
a deciding being.
Then that sort of fundamental assumption that we make about the nature of the self, I don't think is going to be incompatible with atheism.
How so?
Because we're talking about what the self is here. I mean, atheists believe in the self. Everybody believes in the
self. Well, no, that's not. I mean, that I find difficult to believe. Why would an atheist believe in the self? The self is a series of non-deciding mechanisms, as you've described. I see that your view of the self is an atheist view of the self, a meatball wandering through space, as I've put it somewhat colorfully, the sort of Spinoza idea that you're a stone that's been thrown, and you can comprehend that you've been thrown, but you're a stone that's been thrown, and that's just the way that it is.
So this now, all of a sudden, it turned into a debate on libertarian free will versus compatibilist free will. I don't know whether or not the moderator realizes that we've strayed from the topic, but it's like we're 18 minutes in now, and nobody has specifically argued for or against the actual topic.
Why would there be in atheist philosophy such a thing as a deciding self? The deciding self, the deciding being, is external to the idea of an evolutionary cause, because the very word deciding suggests uncaused decision making, and you've just excluded it through your own philosophy.
Uncaused decision making, I suppose, is a concept that I think is unintelligible, and therefore, if there is an unintelligibility of the self on atheism, I suppose the thrust of the criticism that I made to essentially every point you made in that video, except for the argument from motion, is that what you're saying to me, if it applies to atheism, I think simultaneously applies to theism as well.
How so?
An uncaused decision. I mean, what is the process by which a decision is made?
But now you're falling into the same sort of argument that I excluded at the beginning, which was I said that the beauty of religion is that there's a bunch of stuff I don't understand.
Hmm.
So I can't explain to you how the uncaused self makes decisions.
Well, then I can't explain to you how the uncaused self exists on an atheist.
But you have
framework.
A burden and I don't. Meaning that
I don't think that's the case.
You do, though. I mean, the simple fact is that you are the one who's claiming that a reasonable materialist universe is the cause of all. And so if that's the case, you do have to explain the mechanism in a way that I certainly do not. My entire philosophy rests on the positing of an entire realm of things I don't understand in terms of their interaction with the world. Now, as I said—
So this is a very interesting point that Shapiro is making. Not sure if you caught it, but there are two issues at hand right now. The first one is, how does it work? How does free will work when it comes to human action? So that's a functional question. But then there's another issue, and that is, how does free will fit into your worldview? O'Connor just asked Shapiro the first question, and Shapiro basically said, well, I don't know, right? To the answer to the functional question, I don't know. But then he said, well, you have another burden, O'Connor, and that's the second question. How can you speak of decision-making while also saying at the very same time that we have no free will? What does this have to do with the topic? Beats me! We've strayed quite a bit, but let's see where this goes.
At the very beginning, that leaves me a giant escape hatch. I'm not going to pretend that that's not a giant escape hatch. It acts in practice as a giant escape hatch. It also tends to act as a fundamental principle of faith, right? Again, in every moral realm, right? When you get to the problem of good and evil, right? One of the big questions is, well, how can God allow evil to take place in the world? And the fundamental religious answer, as it has been for thousands of years, is my mind is not God's, which is a giant escape hatch. It also happens to be true from a religious point of view.
So if I may, that there are two sort of escape hatches here. There are two appeals to mystery going on here. And it seems to me that what you're saying is something along the lines of my simple appeal to mystery here is disallowed in the way that you're allowed to appeal to this mystery, because I'm the one making the claim. I think that
not because I'm the one making the claim, but because the—
I'm the one with the burden. In the context of this discussion, I'm
missing the who's the you and the who's the I in
yes.
a sense, but yes.
I see what you mean. I'm speaking for myself there.
Sorry.
If, in the context of this discussion, this began, the subject, which I think is the first one you bring up in this video, free will. Here's this thing that I think exists, and on the basis of its existence, think entails the existence of a God, or at least points to the existence of a God. I shouldn't say entail. And then when I say that I don't think that the concept of free will is intelligible, and you say, well, how is it intelligible on atheism? And I say, I'm not sure it is, but it's not on theism either. And you say, well, there's my escape hatch. I can appeal to mystery. I don't think the burden is on me there. I think you are the one who's making the claim that free will does exist, that there is this mysterious property of the universe
that escapes this determined or indeterminated
dichotomy. And then when I say that this is unintelligible to me and based on what I see to be fundamentally appeal to a law of logic, suddenly I'm the one making the claim. I'm the one with the burden who has to do the proving.
No,
I've not seen the video that they keep referring to. Have you? Has somebody seen it? Let me know. Was there some beef? Or, you know, there's a back and forth between O'Connor and Shapiro. I missed that whole thing, right? The backdrop for this particular point of discussion. I will say O'Connor just did a great job of laying a framework to give himself advantage over Shapiro in this particular exchange. You know, notice how he sort of went back. Well, here's what happened, and that has led to this moment right now. But I think O'Connor, in doing that, might have missed Shapiro's point. I'll let this play out.
So the actual claim that I originally made, if you recall, was a conditional claim. Mm-hmm. I did not claim free will exists, therefore God. I claimed if you believe free will exists, it cannot exist in a materialist universe. Now, you say, okay, fine, it doesn't exist in a materialist universe. I don't believe in free will.
Yes.
That's fine. That's totally plausible. As I said right at the top here, mm-hmm. I'm not going to prove to you that God exists today. What I am going to say is that the vast majority of people throughout nearly all of human history have believed there is a thing called a self. It is a deciding self that makes these decisions. If you are a person who believes that, you're right. It can't exist in your world. So I'm not saying that it does exist. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're totally right. And all of this is just a series of chemical firings. That's quite plausible. That's fine. What I have said, and this is the argument that hasn't yet been rebutted, is that society does require an extraordinary number of people to believe that they are capable of making decisions for the good or for the bad. Because again, not everybody is you. Not everybody is capable of waking up in the morning, putting one half of their brain on hold, the side that says, what I'm doing today doesn't matter, and we are all going to wind up in the cosmic nothingness of space anyway, and the sun's going to explode and eat the earth. Most people don't function that way. Mm. And so a functional society, a society that actually works, relies on people actually believing that their fate is in their hands. And the way that people tend to understand that on a day-to-day level.
So we're now getting into the most replayed moment of the entire debate. I think we've finally gotten the closest to actually touching on the topic, okay? And that's when Shapiro said, well, people need to believe that they're free in order for, you know, society to function and to flourish, right? The connection to religion has not quite been made other than to quickly allude to the connection between free will and the overall religious worldview, right? So a lot more can be done to distinctly make those connections, but at least it's something. And so let's find out what the most replayed moment looks like.
Is I get up in the morning and I make a decision whether I'm taking my kids to school today. I get up in the morning and I decide whether I'm giving charity today. I get up in the morning and I decide whether to go to a job today. Because the truth is that for a huge number of people, and I would say this is true for many, 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 I would say the majority of people, if they were informed since the time they were small that their decision-making process does not exist. There is no decision to be made. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Those decisions have no moral weight in the universe because the universe has no moral weight. There is no way to create a functional society on the basis of these premises. There may be a Platonic world where philosophers, you know, can think about this in the gardens of their imagination and feel great about it, but that's not actually how society functions, not for children, not for teenagers, not for adults.
Yes. And we're going to go on and talk about that in the second section. I had free will to ask any of the questions I've had written down here, but I just didn't want to. I didn't want to stop either of you. It's been breathless and captivating. I'm sure you'll agree. Before we go to our first break, we are going to go on and talk about society and how morality undergird society and civilization.
May I just say, just I know we're coming to the end of the section, just to close off this moment, that if people listening agree with me that free will in fact doesn't exist, and simultaneously agree with you that free will is somehow necessary for the upkeep of civilization, then I would simply ask them to consider who's relying on the delusion here, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as an insult, but you see what I'm saying.
I totally agree. And so from my argument, you would be, and from your argument, I would be. Yeah. Meaning, I think that
That seems at first blush like it's a great soundbite from O'Connor, but I don't know what that achieved for him ultimately. Because if O'Connor is right and free will does not exist, and Shapiro is right that people need to believe in free will in a religious framework in order for society to function, then Shapiro just won the debate, guys. The topic is religion good for society? I take it that good has something to do with functionality. So then we're all deluded. Also, Shapiro just won the debate. Hey, real quick, I'm so grateful that you're watching. If I've earned the right to get your sub, I'd love it if you would just click the like and subscribe button. It would really help me to get the video out to more and more people. I really do appreciate you.
Alex, we started with Ben in the first section. Let's start with you. What for you makes an outcome good or bad? And feel free to break that down, define things as you want. And how do we determine what is good and acceptable in society?
Here is where I may disappoint you and potentially excite Mrs. Shapiro in that I don't have a good answer to that question. Okay. In that obviously attempts have been made for a long time to ground God, to ground good outside of God. I must say that similarly to rehash the same theme, I think there are issues with grounding good in God as well. I don't think that removes the problem. I don't quite know what good is, if it indeed exists. I'm quite suspicious of the concept. I think it might be another one of these unfortunately quite nihilistic evolutionary sort of illusions of a sort. I guess I ascribe to emotivism more than anything, which has sort of gone out of fashion in the past decade, but I think still has some truth to it.
I'm having deja vu. I think I reacted to another debate between Alex O'Connor and Michael Jones. I think so. And he talked about this. He brought this up. The problem with emotivism, in my opinion, is that in the view, actions are not right or wrong, good or evil, in and of themselves. They are amoral in that sense, which relegates, it situates morality within our language, the terms that we use to describe human actions. That makes morality an ultimately meaningless, it's like a series of grunts of emotion. And yet we sense on a deep intuitive level that actions are good and evil in and of themselves. But we have to deny those intuitions in order to agree with emotivism.
Sense, it's more of a philosophy of language than it is a philosophy of what good and bad actually is. What I do know, however, is that there are problems, I think, with trying to ground morality in the existence of a God, especially if it's done so on the grounds that it essentially can't be done anywhere else. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the religions of the world are false. I think that they are incorrect. That is, I don't think there really is a supernatural authority. And what that means is that the inventions of religious morality are just those, inventions, and inventions of a human mind. Now, if you have a human morality that recognizes that it is essentially a series of compromises between the history of mankind trying to get along with each other on a planet, then what happens is sometimes these ideas and these philosophies rub up against the real world and we can adapt them as necessary. Now, there is a deep problem with this, and that is, if I meet a man who wants to kill me, or a friend, and he says that he doesn't believe in God, there's very little I can do to talk him out of that, except I can threaten him with legal sanction, I can threaten him with moral reproach, exclusion from the moral community, but there's not much more I can do. However, if a person says that he wants to kill me, and he believes that he wants to kill me because God has told him to do so, then I don't even have that minimal reproach available to me, because there is no law written by any man of any time that could ever count one iota against the dictates of the creator of the universe. Therefore, if that God in fact does not exist, and if these moralities are in fact human inventions, then what you have in the grounding of an ethical system in the dictates, allegedly, of the creator of the universe is all of the arbitrariness and subjectivity and failure and faults of nihilism and human invented morality.
And this is what I was talking about at the outset. I said this at the very, very beginning. Because, of course, O'Connor's not talking about Judaism. He's not talking about Christianity. He's probably not even talking about Buddhism. He's talking about Islam. And this is the problem with making the topic so broad that you categorically include all religions of the entire world everywhere. Because now O'Connor can talk about God when he really means Allah. And he can talk about a man when the backdrop for this is the same as it was for Hitchens, for Dawkins, for folks who came before O'Connor, for Sam Harris. And that was, the backdrop was 9/11.
With all of the certainty and all of the faith and all of the unanswerability of the creator of the universe, that to me seems a dangerous cocktail that we drink at our peril.
So many things there, and so much that you're saying is quite brilliant. I actually thought you were going in a different direction with that last example, which I'll explain in a second. So yeah, to start with the very beginning, obviously the idea of right and wrong. So there are many problems with the motivism. Alistair McIntyre does a good job sort of breaking down the problems with the motivism. The sort of idea that there have to be certain moral absolutes that are beyond contention. And those moral absolutes have to be universally accepted. You can ground that, I suppose, in a sort of descriptive universe. The problem is that, to go back to your example, which again I think is a really interesting one, if a man comes to kill me, I think the real question of religion versus non-religion in the utility sphere here is it more likely that a man is going to come to kill you being a devotee of a religion that says that he must kill you? Or is it more likely that a man is going to kill you out of self-interest because he is not a devotee of a God who says that killing is wrong? So if you are faced with these two alternatives, to kind of...
Which is to silently sort of gesture or point to the violence that takes place all the time on the streets of major crime-ridden cities like Chicago, New York, Las Vegas, where I'm from. The violence is increasing over there, unfortunately. And a lot of other places where murder takes place, but not in the name of Jesus Christ or any other God, but in the name of, as Shapiro points out, self-interest and revenge. Or greed, or whatever it is. So this is a great... What's great about these two is they're really both great at reframing the discussion, okay? This is a great reframe of the discussion, which is what you should do as an interlocutor in this kind of thing. You should reframe the discussion from a perspective that is more advantageous to your position. And like I said, both Shapiro and O'Connor, they're really, really good at that.
Remove your example one step. The question is why the man has come to kill you. I mean, that's the your premise is the man has come to kill you because God told him to, and so he can't be dissuaded by force. Agreed. We see that full scale in the real world on a fairly regular basis. It is also true that over the course of human history, men have come to kill one another on the basis of self-interest in extraordinary amounts of the time. Tribal self-interest, particularly, having no particular relationship with God, just the idea that I want to kill you over territory, I want to kill you over resources, I want to kill you because you're not a member of my immediate kin family, or because you killed a member of my kin family, and so in revenge, I need to kill a member of your kin family. The entire, to borrow from your language, the entire sort of evolution of religion on a utility basis would have been to create moral absolutes that are applicable more broadly than to you and your friends. Any morality that can be created on an individual level is inherently dangerous because you can immediately graft that morality onto your personal self-interest. The entire purpose of religion, whether you want to ground that in evolutionary brain functionings, whether you want to ground that in revelation, the entire purpose of religion on a utility level is to remove morality from the purview of my special interest and to say, here are things that I cannot do, even if they are in my interest, because there is a higher power that says I cannot do these things.
This is a brilliant response, and I think this showcases Shapiro's ability to flip the script that he has been handed, again, in a manner that is advantageous to him. By the way, this all sounds manipulative, right? Reframe, right? Lay a framework that is advantageous to you. But that's not what it is. Shapiro came to the table absolutely believing what he's saying, thoroughly convinced that his position is not only the position that he's going to argue from with regard to the topic, but also this is true. And O'Connor is doing the same thing. He's coming to the table absolutely convinced that what he's saying is true. And so that's the rhetorical dance of debate, is this kind of framing and reframing and laying another framework down. As I've always said, more often than not, the one who lays a better framework typically wins. If the audience adopts your framework, you typically win, whether you had the better substantive arguments or not. I've got a few more minutes here, so let's see what happens.
I think it's all very well and good when this religious tradition is protecting what you think is good. But as we know, it can do the exact opposite, and it can do so with the same force.
Sure.
And I suppose the question we have to ask is whether this is a worthwhile trade-off. That is to say, you know, that there may be some social utility in putting our fundamental ethical assumptions outside of the realm of debate. But when those ethical statements begin to inspire what we would probably consider to be less than socially cohesive behavior, there is nothing you can do, nothing to talk people out of them, because precisely because that's where they've placed them. And that seems dangerous to me. And it seems, for example, you know, a lot of people talk about how religion can make people happier, it can make people more socially cohesive, it can promote people to start families and have children. This is true of most religions. This is also true of Islam, which I'm not sure you would want to say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm not sure you'd want to say is a force for good in the world. I don't think, in other words, that it's always a worthwhile trade-off. Now,
I agree with you, by the way.
Just because you mentioned the sort of culture of Europe and its success in America is indebted to Christianity. I mean, this is of course true in a sense, but there's been a recent revival, it seems. I don't really know quite how it's happened. I think it's got a lot to do with Tom Holland, maybe. That's the historian, not the superhero.
Not Spider-Man.
This idea that
Although
actually...
he's good too. He's a good
actually, the great... I wonder what he would have to say on all of this. the Western civilization sort of depends and should be in gratitude to a religious tradition because it provided this kind of ethical framework in which this could have arisen. We hear about the scientific enlightenment. We hear about, you know, the grounding of ethics and God, the creation of natural rights, as if these things weren't established in resistance all the way along to the religious tradition. A society that today, I'll expand on this if you like, a society today that decides that religion throughout its history has been wrong about the position of women in society, wrong about the mortal fate of practicing homosexuals, wrong about the position of the earth in relation to the sun, wrong about the age of both of those celestial bodies, wrong about the common evolutionary ancestry of every animal, including the human animal on planet Earth, wrong about the ownership of other human beings as private property, now has to contend with a religious tradition that doesn't come to us with contrition and apology and say, well, maybe we were wrong about these things. But no, these are all our things after all. We're going to claim these things. That is, you know, I know that St. Paul says, I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority over a man. Rather, she should remain silent, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and that man is the glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. But don't you know that the social justice movement is essentially Judeo-Christian in origin? I know that the Old Testament not only explicitly condones the ownership of other human beings as private property, but gives detailed instructions about exactly how to buy and indeed take them, sometimes including as sexual property. But don't you know that the abolitionist movement was essentially Judeo-Christian in origin?
This is a ripoff of Hitchens. Hitchens did this very, very... This is the exact same move that he would do on the debate stage as well, even down to the phrase, but don't you know, and then listing his grievances against Christianity and Judaism, which, by the way... It's very persuasive to run through these examples very quickly. It's actually less persuasive when you slow down and investigate these examples, and more importantly, when you investigate the premise, because the premise is fundamentally flawed. But if you don't do that, then this seems really great and probably compelling for a lot of people to hear this. So I suppose it's to O'Connor's advantage that he goes really fast.
Yes, I know that Galileo was shown the instruments of torture by the Inquisition for having the temerity to suggest that the Earth might orbit the Sun rather than the other way around. But don't you know that the scientific revolution, which he authored, was essentially Judeo-Christian in origin? I'd find it funny if it wasn't so offensive to the people who established these very developments against the very religious traditions that now want to claim them as their own.
Okay, so I would buy that, except for the fact that many of the people that you mention in these contexts explicitly counted themselves as religious believers and were speaking in the name of the religion while they were doing it. So to take the abolitionist movement as an example, I mean, William Wilberforce, obviously a tremendously religious person and a big believer in the New Testament. Isaac Newton, obviously deeply ensconced in the New Testament, right? Yeah, certainly important to the scientific revolution. The point about religion, and this is why when I wrote my book, what I have to name the title now and plug myself because that's the way
you got
that
to
works.
Wave
the
around
of, yeah, the right side of history. But the reason that I talked about how reason and moral purpose made the West is because I think that one of the fundamental precepts of at least Judeo-Christian religion is that when God gives a text or a set of ideas to human beings, he expects us to use our reason to apply to those texts. And so the sort of evolution of interpretation is part of the religious tradition. I mean, that's always been the case in my religion anyway. So I can only, I always hesitate to speak on behalf of other people's religions because I don't know them nearly as well as I know my own. So when I talk about sort of the application of reason to tradition in the religious tradition, obviously we have books and books and books of texts discussing and debating these very ideas. And the idea of religious debate has always been central to the idea of Judeo-Christian religion. And when it hasn't been, it's been seen as oppressive and has spawned then other Christian movements that then argue with the original movement and end up generating in almost Hegelian fashion some new form of interpretation.
A fascinating discussion. A brilliant response by Shapiro. The question is, who won this debate, right? Because there was no formal structure to this. It's really hard to ascribe points to various segments of this discussion. Because again, I mean, that's what this was. It was a discussion. I always struggle with this, you know, with Unbelievable, you know, the format on Unbelievable, because it really is more designed for that. And actually, that is, I think, more beneficial when you sort of remove the formal structure of debate and replace it with much more interpersonal conversation. That shows people what it looks like to be congenial, to be collegial, you know, to just be a human being and be friendly. So, you know, there's lots of benefits for this, but it just makes it hard for me to sort of pronounce a winner. Having said that, both Shapiro and O'Connor were strong opponents. I think O'Connor had some brilliant things to say, and so did Shapiro. But to me, the interesting moment, right, that stands out right now was at the end of the first segment where, in my opinion, Shapiro poked O'Connor by saying that his original point has yet to be rebutted, and the reality is it hadn't. So if the topic of the debate is religion good for society, and we grant the necessary components of free will within the religious framework, then O'Connor's point that free will does not exist could not overcome Shapiro's position. Because, as we saw, even if O'Connor is right, Shapiro still won, right? So I struggle to pronounce a winner. But that was a very interesting moment for me. But what about you? Who do you think won this debate? You probably have to watch the whole thing to draw that kind of a conclusion. But let me know in the comments below. I'd love to get your thoughts. This was a fascinating discussion. Professional, productive. That's what it looks like, okay? Unlike other debates, like maybe one we saw last week. This one was way better, okay? That's all the time I have for this one. As always, if you made it this far, you got to join the Patreon community. Come on, what are you waiting for? Even just to read the Bible with me, we're doing a Bible study together over on Patreon, and that's for free for anyone who wants to join. You can also get exclusive access to videos like this before they make it to YouTube, and you can join me for exclusive live streams and ask me anything you want. The link for the Patreon is below, but hey, I'm going to return soon with more videos. I hope you're doing well. In the meantime, I'll say bye for now.